With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hello, West Virginia. Hello, America. Hello, world. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, good middle of the night to you. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is Head On for, yes, a Wednesday night. And, of course, it being a Wednesday night, well, you know what that means.
On this every other Wednesday afternoon discussion club, we are going to have more to discuss on this every other Wednesday afternoon than we ever had on any other every other Wednesday afternoon.
Darn tootin', it is prayer meeting, brethren and sistren. It is Wednesday night prayer meeting, middle of the week. Come on down to the altar and get your magic cracker that will immediately turn into human flesh in your tummy. Have a little sip of grape juice that'll turn into blood. And lay your hands on the subwoofers and feel the healing rays of faith a-blowing through your body. Oh, glory! That's right. Let's by all means start out the program with some typically right-wing caca. The American Family Association, you know, our friends, our buddies, the people who really make prayer meeting possible when you get right down to it, the American Family Association out of Mississippi, is all hit up and bothered about ESPN anchorwoman Dana Jacobson. Dear Bob, Brother Bob, ESPN and its parent company, ABC, have refused to take any action against ESPN anchorwoman Dana Jacobson for her hateful, slurring remarks against Jesus, saying, F Jesus. Yes, I know. On January 11th, Jacobson was speaking at a celebrity roast at Atlantic City, New Jersey, when she unleashed a profane tirade saying, F Notre Dame, F touchdown Jesus, and finally, F Jesus. Touchdown Jesus is the popular moniker for a statue of Jesus raising his arms located on the Notre Dame campus. No, it's not, you morons! It's on the building! But, you know, never mind. Facts have never been known to get in the way of the American Family Association. And now, this is the weird part. I mean, this is the kind of thing that makes me just figure that the email's just going to burst into little electron-driven flames right on my monitor. Catholic League President Bill Donahue spoke with ESPN about the attack and received an email from Jacobson, which basically treated the incident as a non-event. The statement said, in part, "I respect all religions and did not mean anything derogatory by my poorly chosen words." What a wimp out. Jacobson's comments were at a public event where she was representing ESPN. The fact that neither ESPN nor ABC has taken any action, nor even Disney, against Jacobson indicates they have a bias against Christians. Donahue said that Jacobson should be fired. This anti-Christian bias of the networks is becoming commonplace. Actress Kathy Griffin used her appearance on the Emmy Awards program to tell Jesus to suck it, responding to athletes who thank Jesus when they achieve certain levels right after their touchdown dance. No action was taken against Griffin, neither. The hell, what kind of action do they want to be taking against Kathy Griffin? They want to, I know what they want. I know what these freaks from the religion industry want. They want to take Kathy Griffin and Dana Jacobson out and strip them naked and look, and holler, "Harlot, harlot," and start throwing rocks at them. Hit them with a big one, Junior. Jiminy. No, the reason I said I expected this email to burst into flames is the idea of the American Family Association endorsing the words of Catholic League President Bill Donahue, when in fact, you know, when the doors are closed, you know how it is with them Catholics, them Mary worshipers, idol worshipers, every last one of them, they're going to burn in hell because they ain't been born again. They worship that Pope feller. Because that's how it is with American fundamentalists. The worst religious bigots on planet Earth are fundamentalists. You know, I don't see anybody. They don't have any respect for a Buddhist. They have no respect for a Hindu or a Jain or a Shinto or an animist. Very little respect for Jews. Utterly no respect for Muslims. But I don't see them. I don't see them offering to just step off the world stage because they have no sensitivity toward religion. You know, I realize that because this thing does go around the world. It's only 10 a.m. in Australia, and it's only 3 p.m. on the West Coast, middle of the night in Europe. But so I refrain from using the words that I would like to use toward people like the Reverend Donald Wildman. Because, see, it's people like Donald Wildman who make other people say things like F Jesus. And who absolutely get sick when they see professional athletes, multimillionaires, dancing around in the end zone and pointing and blowing kisses at the sky and hollering, "Thank you, Jesus!" You know, because Jesus threw the pass and not Eli Manning or Peyton or Tom Brady or the Philip Rivers or whomever. Jesus got the ball to me. It's no difference than the stupidity of radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huckabee, who says that when he goes to blow away some poor animal out on the Midwestern plains, that angels carry. I didn't make this up. You know this. That angels carry his bullet to the target and blow apart its insides and make it drop dead right there for his giggling sport. No difference. Not a dime's worth. Oh, and speaking of radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huckabee, I finally had to write a little note. Of course, I know where it goes. It's straight into a spam file. But I dropped a little note to CNN today. You know, gentle, respectful, pleasant, asking them to please straighten up. Yeah, I know. It's like telling a heroin addict to, you know, get sober. Because I saw, you know, the headline was "Thompson Abandons White House Bid." Talking about drop-dead Fred, you know, half-dead Fred, getting out of the race yesterday. And I ran across a couple of lines in there that just made me want to scream. Where'd it go? CNN political correspondent Bill Schneider said that... Bill Bennett. This is Bingo Billy Bennett. Blackjack Billy. Sitting there naked in his room with the million, with the $10,000 coin slot machine, eating Cheetos and gambling in Vegas in the high roller room. He's really been good lately, but it's too late. If you're a Southern conservative and you can't make it in South Carolina, it's over. Well, thank you for restating the obvious there, Bill Bennett, you paragon of virtue, you. But yeah, he's really been good lately, but it's too late. How the hell did they know? I mean, did they get more fog on the mirror when they held it in front of his mouth? It's the only way you could tell whether the dude was alive or not. But the thing that crawled all over me was the line, this line. While he did draw some evangelical voters from one-time Baptist preacher and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, yada, yada, yada. One-time Baptist preacher. One time. Yeah, just one time, you know, he crawled up into the pulpit, he slithered up into the pulpit, he handled some snakes, drank some strychnine, and spoke in tongues a little bit, but then he was all better, and it was over, and he wasn't a Baptist preacher anymore. He was a one-time Baptist preacher. So I just dropped a note to CNN, politely, and I do mean, I'm sincere, quite politely, informing them that there is nothing out there in the record to suggest that Mike Huckabee has ever surrendered his license to preach or rejected his ordination, or that the Southern Baptist Convention has ever rescinded his ordination or told him he was no longer an ordained minister. Now, by my lights, that means he's not a one-time Baptist preacher. He is a still-doing-it Baptist preacher, especially in light of the fact that he has gone into the pulpit during this campaign season and delivered sermons, saying things like, I'm not here for politics today, I'm just going to preach for a while like I used to do. This is just another sermon. Just going to preach to you. See, that's called preaching a sermon. But, you know, who the heck am I? But that's my little crusade lately. You know, getting people to at least be, trying to get the media to at least be honest about radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huckabee. I don't expect them to call him radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huckabee, because that's more honest than the American mainstream media are capable of. We'll leave the real honesty to folks like us on the horn. But they could at least quit referring to him as a former preacher. You know, unless you've actually been caught doing the meth with the gay prostitute and been subsequently defrocked by your denomination, you're not a former preacher. You're a preacher till the day you die. It's one of those things that's in the situation and in the person. Other religious reference that bugs the hell out of me. Democrat Barack Obama stepped up his efforts Tuesday to battle back against emails that falsely label him a Muslim. Well, I understand that. Those things got started by, gosh, somebody, can't imagine who, the Republican Party, trying to capitalize on his middle name, Hussein, calling him Barack Hussein Obama. But where, and I kind of put this in the Ronald Reagan category, where did he go to refute the rumors of his Muslimness? Well, let's read the paragraph and find out. I think it's very important for people not to buy into the kinds of dirty tricks that we've become so accustomed to in our politics. And people need to understand I'm not, and never have been, of the Muslim faith. Unquote. He told CBN's David Brody. CBN's David Brody. Come on. You know what CBN stands for. Christian Broadcasting Network. It's prayer meeting, brothers and sisters. You know who runs CBN. Yeah, you do. Kind of makes you want to gag a little bit, or as Stephanie Miller says, throw up a little bit in the back of your throat to realize it. But, yes, Barack Obama has been hobnobbing, apparently, with the Pat Robertson crowd, giving interviews to CBN, the same CBN that produces news programs in which they talk about how the Earth is slightly younger than the written word, that does news so-called programs about the fact that global warming is a myth, but that a zombie god getting up from being dead and walking around for a while is reality. Yeah, Barack Obama pressing the flesh with the Christian Broadcasting Network. The same Christian Broadcasting Network that features Pat Robertson holding hands with some woman who's had so many facelifts that when she raises her eyebrows, her pantyhose come up. Holding hands with her and saying, "And Jesus, yes, you've told me, Lord, there is a man out there with a smashed toe. And that toe has been healed, Lord. Yes, thank you, Jesus. Thank you. Thank you, Lord, for healing that toe. Thank you for driving the demon out of that man's toenail. Thank you, Jesus. Amen and amen." Yeah, that's CBN and that Pat Robertson. You know, CBN, owned by Pat Robertson, who, you know, drives pathetic, poverty, bedraggled Liberian people to grim and grisly, ghastly, pathetic deaths in his insatiable drive for diamonds. That Pat Robertson. How am I supposed to feel about that? Honest to God, how am I supposed to feel about that, coming from a man who wants me to vote for him as a Democrat? How am I supposed to feel about that? Who does he think he's going to influence? Does he, honest to God, think that anybody who spends any significant portion of their finite little lives watching the Christian Broadcasting Network is going to change their mind about him as compared to, say, a Huckabee or a Giuliani? Remember, Pat Robertson endorsed Giuliani. Or a McCain or a Romney? Does he really think he's going to make a difference there? I want to make sure that people are absolutely clear about what's going on with this, and if they get another one of these emails, that they're deleting it and letting their friends know that it's nonsense. Poor Senator Obama, don't you understand that the kind of people who watch the Christian Broadcasting Network are the very ones who are gleefully forwarding that email, buddy? I mean, I'm not down on you. I'm not down on you, Senator Obama. I'm not. But somewhere along the way, somebody's got to give you a little bit of smarten up. Don't go messing with the religion industry people. They are not going to vote for you. They are only going to, because they're a bunch of backstabbers, they're going to wait until your back is to them, and then your ribs are going to sprout shivs. Because that's what they do. And you're not going to create your the outreach to them there. It doesn't work that way. This is a divided nation, Senator Obama. And it's not likely to change anytime soon. Best to work with the people that can get you to Washington and quit this business of bowing and scraping and kowtowing to the religious right. Because, you know, when you pick up a rattlesnake and the rattlesnake bites you, you're the only one who's going to be surprised. Because rattlesnakes aren't surprised. That's what rattlesnakes do. But I was trying to build a coalition and give people hope across the... They don't want hope, Senator Obama. They don't want hope at all. They are vindictive and they are hateful. That is why they are members of the right-wing fundamentalist religion industry. It's like that great bumper sticker slogan I saw the other night. How can you tell if your God is man-made? Answer, if he hates all the same people you do. So I don't know what to expect next. Maybe Senator Obama will go and sit down with Pat Robertson and pray for somebody's smashed toe. Lord God, I hope not. I sure enough hope not. But that's basically where we find ourselves this fine and lovely Wednesday evening. Quick update from the West Virginia front with you. You know, I told you last week about Dirty Spike Maynard getting caught frolicking with Don Blankenswine in Don Blankenship in the French Riviera. In the duchy of, or the principality, I'm sorry, it's a principality, the principality of Monaco. And then, of course, Spike Maynard came home and joined in a majority that made a $75 million judgment against Massey Energy. Just disappear. It was like magic. Just gone. Well, once he got caught, Spike really had no choice but to recuse himself from the any further considerations of the case. But he's up for re-election this year. And I just thought I'd let you know, because, you know, I say things to you from time to time, like people who are just working schlubs in West Virginia, just working folks, getting it, you know, I find that uniquely American. They're working three jobs. People who oppose mountaintop removal, people who want real jobs, a real economy in West Virginia, instead of this stinking mercantilist mono economy that we have here, we don't have a voice. We don't have a voice at all. The proof in the pudding. Spike Maynard, dirty, 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 dirty Supreme Court justice, plans to run this year for another 12-year term on the Supreme Court, this from a report in the Charleston Gazette. And his campaign committee has recently sent out invitations for a fundraiser scheduled for tomorrow at the home of Senator Truman Chafin, who is a Democrat from Mingo County and has a home in Charleston. Senator Truman Chafin, D. Mingo, will be the host of the big party, and there will be special guests at that party, including Governor Joe Manchin, D., and Senate President Earl Ray Tomlin, Democrat, Logan County, and House Speaker Rick Thompson, Democrat from Wayne County. That is essentially the executive leadership of the state showing up at a party, a fundraising party, for a man who has disgraced the office of Supreme Court Justice. So now maybe you get a little idea about what I mean when I say that if we get any help with the depredations being done to West Virginia, it will be help that comes from far outside the state of West Virginia. Because while we are willing to work hard in our own right, we have no political representation. Period. It is approaching mathematical zero. Okay, let's see. Let's go to the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Hi.
Hey, Juanita.
Hey.
How are you doing? I'm all right.
I want you to say a little bit of something about Pat Robertson, but the reason I called is I got a phone call this morning. It was asking, it was electronic generated, you know, so you had to answer yes or no, so I decided why not. And the first question was, do you approve of the way George Bush is handling the situation in his country?
And that was push two for no, and you're sitting there going, no, 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 no.
And then he wanted to know if I was voting in the Republican primary, and I said no. And then he wanted to know if I was a Democrat, and I said yes, and I thought, well, that'll be it. Then it was that started talking and said, did you realize that Mitt Romney is a millionaire, he's $200 million, and he spent $7 million on his campaign, and McCain is a millionaire, and he's lived in Washington for the past 40 years or whatever, and 50, 30 or whatever. And you said something about Giuliani, about him having a bunch of money. Then it said, and then you have Mike Huckabee, and he was raised poor. He knows what it's like to be poor and to struggle.
Oh, you got a huckster robocall.
And yeah, and so it said, so then the question was, does knowing that Mike Huckabee understands what it's like to struggle and all, does that make you inclined to support him? And I said no. It was a bunch of questions like that about him. Did you know this? And then it wanted to know what did I think was the most important was the subject of, well, didn't say gay marriage, but marriage between men and women, and abortion, and tax breaks. And so it individualized each question, said, is that your most important issue? And I said no to all of them, I mean, because they're not.
No.
Anyway, it was funny. They finally quit asking.
Oh,
and what was odd was they threw in Bill Nelson, wanted to know, did I have a good opinion of him? Well, right now, no. I don't know why he got in the picture, but it was all Mike Huckabee this, and does that make you want to support him?
You know he's a minister of the gospel, don't you? That makes him an honest man.
But what I want to tell you about Pat Robertson is that, and a lot of people that are members of 700 Club don't know it yet, because I keep meeting them all the time, that he sold that to Rupert Murdoch for I don't know how many.
He sold CBN?
Huh?
He sold CBN?
Oh, it's been at least 15 years, if not, you know, yeah. I didn't know it for a long time. And with the caveat that they had the 700 Club stay on, you won't find nothing else on there but them. It's supposed to be a family show, family thing. Yeah, he sold it. He didn't ask nobody. He just sold it and kept the money.
Well, it was his.
But it's Rupert Murdoch he sold it to.
I'll be darned.
And a lot of the members don't know that yet. I'll say, did you know that he no longer has that? No. Well, he sold it. And he sold it, I don't know how for many millions or billions of dollars. I mean, that guy's a billionaire.
I'll be darned.
And another thing he did when he ran for president, you know, they kept calling him an evangelist, and he said, no, I'm not an evangelist. It was kind of like you're saying about Huckabee, like he wanted to get away from being associated with being a pastor. Well, he was supposed to have been a pastor. And like you say, once they're a pastor, they're not. And he was a Baptist pastor, too. So, you know, they don't let that go.
Oh, No, you're right. You're right.
But, yeah, Pat Robertson, and you know the people, including me, have to build that station. I have a little, it's had a little, quite an investment. For me, it was a lot of investment. But nobody asked my opinion.
But it wasn't an investment. It was a love offering.
Of course.
That's the way these that's the way these shysters operate.
Yeah.
You know, if we had any kind of oversight of religion, there wouldn't be Creflo dollars flying around. You know, who needs two Rolls Royces? You can only ride in one at a time.
And I was so screwed up at that time till I was trying to support Tom, Dick, and Harry, you know, I was so needy, and I might not have been quite as needy if I hadn't been in that kind of situation, but, oh well, live and learn. I'm glad I got out of it.
Yeah, we all are.
My heart was just not in it. It just could not be in it.
No.
But anyway, I wanted to tell you about my little phone call I got this morning.
Well, that's must have just started your day off at a, you know, at a rolling boil.
I couldn't believe it. It was all about, oh, he's just the best Republican ever. And, of course, that didn't help me at all. That didn't hold sway with me at all.
No. If you had sat there and made notes about the progress of which questions were asked when, what would be interesting to know was exactly what the progress of questions were when you punched in and said, "I am a Democrat."
Yeah, it would have been, wouldn't it?
But then again, you live in one of those you live in one of those states where Democrats can vote in the Republican primary and Republicans can vote in the Democratic primary.
I don't think so. If you can, it's changed. It didn't used to could.
Oh, really? I thought most southern states were that way.
No, unless we've changed lately. And it could very well be. No, if you're an independent, you can't vote in the primary.
But the primaries are open in that if you're a Republican, you can go vote in the Democratic primary and vice versa.
Well, I was wondering why they asked me that. Maybe that's right. Maybe that's what it is now. You know, they're always changing things without letting you know. But the third question was, are you a Democrat? And I said, yes. You know, but then they asked a lot of, the first question was one I told you about, the fact that he was poor and had to struggle when he was growing up, so that incline you to vote for him. Or to support him, not to vote, but support him. I said, no. That was the first question. And one of them was about abortion rights, and one of them was about the taxes. Well, like I said, they brought out those three things, wanting to know if those were, which was the most important. Well, those are not my most important ones. You know, they're not the way they're looking at them anyway. But, I thought it was kind of interesting. I know some people say they're not called, but I get called every once in a while, but I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, it is. And the thing is, let's see, the primary is what, the 29th?
Yeah, next Tuesday.
Yeah, 6 days from now. My money says you get a few more of those calls, Juanita.
Okay, well, I'll let you know.
All right, do please, and have yourself a great night.
You too, and you check that out of what I said about Pat. Yeah, he sold that sucker.
Well, I bet you somebody will email that to me in a matter of minutes. So
yeah, he sold it.
I'll be darned. Well, all right. Thanks a lot, Juanita. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye. And an update has rolled in from our good friend Marty out on the West Coast. Apparently, Dana Jacobson sort of made an ass of herself. But, you know, not necessarily because she said, you know, F Notre Dame, F touchdown Jesus, and F Jesus for that matter. The description from the AP story that Marty has sent me indicates that, ESPN commentators shared the stage with actors and athletes January 11th in Atlantic City to celebrate the 8th anniversary of Mike and Mike in the Morning co-hosts Mike Golic and Mike Greenberg. The whole point was to spout off edgy jokes, but what's okay for comedians Eddie Griffin and Jeffrey Ross may not be appropriate for ESPN announcers seeking to be both entertainers and journalists. This woman's not a journalist. She's talking head. But anyway, it says that she has been disciplined by a week-long suspension, and that while she was going off with Irish football coach Charlie Weiss in attendance, really? That Mike and Mike just sat there resting their heads in their hands in embarrassment, and she was booed off the stage. The Press of Atlantic City, I suppose, is a newspaper there, and they reported that, quote, Jacobson made an absolute fool of herself, swilling vodka from a Belvedere bottle, mumbling along and cursing like a sailor. Jesus. Well, nice to see that ABC, Disney, ESPN have knuckled under to the religion industry once again. How is it that the religion industry can wail away on atheists all they want and say things like, you know, well, what did the one fundamentalist say? The dumbest Christian would be a better political office holder than the smartest atheist, you know, that kind of thing. How is it that they get away with that and nobody's out there suspending them, but then if you make a joke about whatever their particular god is, that suddenly there's a firestorm? I don't understand that. I don't understand why it is that somebody's personal mythology has the cachet of untouchableness about it. You can't make fun of my invisible critter. That's my invisible critter, and you're going to make me cry. Again, going back to that list that I saw, a moment of brilliance. Don't pray in my classroom, and I won't think in your church. Jiminy. Just, you know, Jiminy. So, you know, there we go. Oh, but it's not all religion and foolishness tonight, not by any stretch of the imagination. No, 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 no. There's a ton of stuff out there. This is one of, most particularly... I saw this earlier in the day, and it was one of those things that sort of, you know, thanks, guys, because on the one hand, it's a matter of, you know, our horses are long gone, and the barn has been burnt down to ash, and some folks come along now and close the barn door. Thank you. Needed that. On the other hand, however, keeping up with the lies of the Bush administration is so doggone, it's a full-time job. And it's nice to see that something like this has finally been quantified. Dateline Washington, Associated Press story. A study by two nonprofit journalism organizations found that President Bush and top administration officials issued hundreds of false statements about the national security threat from Iraq in the 2 years following the 2001 terrorist attacks. I know this comes as a great surprise to you. The study concluded that the statements, quote, were part of an orchestrated campaign that effectively galvanized public opinion and, in the process, led the nation to war under decidedly false pretenses. 24 words. I can distill it to four. Bush lied, people died. Bush lies. People die. Present tense. It was put out there by the Center for Public Integrity, which worked with the Fund for Independence in Journalism. Boy, there's a fund that needs a lot more money. George Bush and top administration officials issued hundreds of false statements. Another word for those. Lies! Issued hundreds of lies about the national security threat from Iraq. The study counted 935 false statements, lies, in the two-year period. It found that in speeches, briefings, interviews, trips to the drive-thru at McDonald's, and other venues... Sorry, I added the trips to the McDonald's part. But, you know, everywhere... You remember, you were there. Every time you turned around, there was Bush, you know, playing golf. And Saddam Hussein wants to use nuclear golf balls on us. If we don't disarm Saddam, we could all get killed by our Titleists. You were there every time you turned around, and I would like to have a chocolate malted with a side order of disarm Saddam because he's a threat to our national security. You were there. You remember. In speeches, in briefings, interviews, and other venues, Bush and administration officials stated unequivocally on at least 532 occasions. 532 occasions. You know, when you do it 532 times, it's not a mistake. That's what you call intentional conduct. On at least 532 occasions, they said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or were trying to produce or obtain them or had links to Al-Qaeda or both or all or any one of the above. You pick one from column A, two from column B. With E, you get egg roll. Charles Lewis and Mark Redding Smith of the Fund for Independence in Journalism said, "It is now beyond dispute that Iraq did not possess any weapons of mass destruction or have meaningful ties to Al-Qaeda." In short, the Bush administration led the nation to war on the basis of erroneous information that it methodically propagated and that culminated in military action against Iraq on March 19th, 2003. Who were some of the other liars besides George Bush? Why, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Don Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Paul Wolfowitz, and White House Press Secretaries Ari Fleischer and Scott McClellan. Of the 935 lies told, Bush led the list with 259. 231 of those were about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. 28 of them were about Iraq's links to Al-Qaeda. The second place, that was second only to Powell's 244 false statements about weapons of mass destruction and 10 about Iraq and Al-Qaeda. I am grateful that I am not one of those people who has lost a loved one in Iraq, because the very thought of it is so painful in its own right. I cannot imagine what it would be like to be one of the people who has lost a loved one in that hell hole, that meat grinder in the sand, and to pick up the newspaper and find out that once and for all, it's all, you know, debunked, the verdict is in. And on 935 separate occasions, George Bush, or one of his hand-picked liars, created the reason that led to that loved one's being taken from the family. The family shattered. The child growing up without a mama or without a daddy. Brothers that no longer have sisters. Sisters no longer having brothers. I cannot imagine what that would make me do. How pathetic. How utterly and completely pathetic. To the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Bob, you got Dave at Eureka Cal.
Hey, Dave, how are you?
Really good. And yourself?
Oh, I'm all right, I guess. I think I ate dinner too close to the showtime, though. I'm a little bit, I feel just a little bit sort of weighed down.
Oh, dear. Well, get somebody to pray for you.
Yeah, let's pray.
What you were just talking about, the fact that these neocons lied us into these invasions, the fact that they had planned it from the earliest days of PNAC, the fact that they had reiterated it at places like Downing Street, how do we still sit by while Pelosi says, no, impeachment is not a consideration? Impeachment is off the table. That is plotting the death of any number of people for their own gains, their own profit.
Well, I don't see folks like you and me, Dave, as just sitting idly by. God knows we rant, we rave, we scream, we beg, we write emails, we make phone calls. Short of going to Washington and holding our spineless little Democratic representatives' little right hands in the air to vote aye on impeachment, we've done pretty much as we can do.
Well, you know, the way I connected, a lot of the Democrats have their hands out to the same big war profiteer corporations. And those billionaire, greedy corporatists, they are quite happy with what we got in the White House. They're benefiting greatly from having them there. And so I think they're saying, no, hands off. If you go after our guys there, we'll shut off your water. And I hope it isn't that, but that's the way I'm connecting it.
It's that, and it's also political avarice, Dave. Nancy Pelosi doesn't have the guts to do the right thing by the Constitution because she doesn't because she sees that as a threat to the consolidation of her power. She thinks if she just lays low and lets Bush get out of town and gets a few more members in the House, she can be really powerful. Whereas she thinks that the American people have no stomach for the impeachment of a criminal.
Well, I think the mail, the email, the phone calls that are falling in on Congress members, including Pelosi, is so much supportive of hold these criminals accountable, do investigate, do impeach. I think the pressure is on...
Robert Wexler has what? In excess of 200,000 signatures on a petition begging for impeachment?
Yeah, yeah.
And that means nothing to Mrs. Pelosi.
See that? Standing up against the people. She's running against a Cindy Sheehan. And San Francisco is a pretty aware, thoughtful town. And I think they're going to be just about at their end with Pelosi. Unless it's all another election on their trick voting machines. I think we may see the end of her. And rightly so. I mean, what she's failed to do here is these people plotted out the death of many, I mean, how many thousands of people?
It's premeditated murder, Dave. I think that's where you're headed, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. They planned it out, and they were going to try it again. They may yet try it again. They want to invade Iran. They're coming up with all the same lies that we went through. We've been on that roller coaster ride before. Ugh.
I know.
I get too frustrated to talk intelligently.
No. You're doing just fine, Dave. And frankly, what you're saying is representative of and symbolic and emblematic of what millions of Americans are saying. Now, in terms of what how to put this, we see polling data for everything in the American experience. As an American, do you prefer puppies or kittens? As an American, do you prefer chocolate or vanilla? As an American, do you prefer Senator Clinton or Senator Obama? Never mind, Senator Edwards. Everything. And yet, the one question we never are allowed to see that nobody will pay for polling on, as an American, do you turn a blind eye to criminal acts perpetrated by the chief executive of this nation and his staff?
Good question. I wonder what kind of responses one would get to that.
I think it would be overwhelmingly, no, we will not tolerate it. Would you support impeachment? It was 2.5-3 years ago, Dave, that the one question was finally asked, if it was proven to you that George Bush lied to start the Iraq War, would you support impeachment? And 3 years ago, Dave, 3 years ago, the American people said yes at 50%. And the question was never asked again.
Well, I've seen things of this magnitude on several occasions with this administration. Their failure to try to aid the Katrina victims, they're sending water trucks away, they're telling a hospital ship, turn around and exit the area. That was a decision that tried to turn a blue area red through murder.
Yeah. And now it's not just Bush lied to start the war. Now we have it quantified. Now we have it in cold, hard, the readable form. George Bush and his cronies and his minions lied 935 times.
That they definitely know of. I'm sure that they were lying more than that, probably too.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't take in pillow talk. But 935 times. That's 935 counts in a bill of impeachment.
Well, you do a wonderful thing, Bob. You know, I'm living on very small income, but I'm going to try to send something to you folks.
Well, hang in there, Dave. It's folks like you that are the reason we do this, okay? I had a conversation with John Fox and Ben Birch last night about, you know, who listens and how they listen and how often they listen, and it was inspiring. And to know that the number of people are out there who are listening to us just blows my mind.
Oh, yeah.
And so for as long as we can continue to do it, we will, because to have the number of listeners that we have in the short span of time that this network has been going, it's mind-boggling. And it's also, you know, this isn't a teaching mission. We go on and on and on talking about, you know, encouraging people like you and Juanita and all the people who call this program to involve themselves in discussion. Because the other side is all about giving marching orders. And so, you know, Rush Limbaugh talks, and you're supposed to sit there and patiently listen until such time you feel compelled to pick up the phone and call in and say, "Mega dittos for Busted Knuckle, you're right, Rush. Why, thank you, my friend." And that's all you can do is validate.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what this is about, and that's not what will save this country.
And in your neck of the woods particularly, there is a goodly number of people that go back and forth between Fox and Limbaugh and Hannity, and they're trying to keep their mind programmed against reality.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, yeah. Nobody's ever going to accuse West Virginia of being a haven of liberal or progressive radio, okay?
Well, the whole southern area there, I think that, you know, you have to get yourself an internet computer if you want to listen to any sanity.
Yeah, and that's why we're here. I mean, we started out on terrestrial radio. That went on for about a year and a half until we were run off by the big money interests of Big Coal and a certain sleazy hospital. And after that, we realized that this is where the market is. This is where the people, not market, this is where the people we can reach are. This is where the people who want to have a conversation are. This is where the smart folks are. So, you know, that's what turned this into an internet radio network.
You know, and those that you need to reach the most, I've got their fingers in their ear until they get in front of their box, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's breaking down. I think more and more people are becoming aware, even against this. I go out and demonstrate every week here in front of our congressman's office. He's a blue dog, and for most of what the Bush people are about. But one young man joined us, and he said, I was very strongly a Christian, and I always believed everything that I was told there. And one day a guy gave me the video Loose Change, and I said I'd read it, let's watch it, and I did, and I watched it again, and I went into depression for a couple of weeks. Now I won't believe a word they tell me.
Well, you know, I believe skepticism is the healthiest human impulse. Because when you stand and you watch the guy up on the top of the temple pyramid or whatever, and he tells you what you're supposed to believe, and you say, yes, Lord, I will believe. Well, you know, you're done thinking. And thinking is the only thing that separates us from the so-called beasts. Our ability to reason. You know, what Descartes said, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. It's not...
Well, I love your network. Well, I love what you're trying to do, and it's whatever I can do to help, I'm going to try to do it.
Well, thank you, Dave. Thank you very much, and you have yourself a great evening, all right?
You too, Bob.
Bye now. And we'll keep this rolling along. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin from Brooklyn.
Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Nothing much. I thought you were live earlier. I called earlier by mistake.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. Not to worry.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I think John Edwards may have his Clinton Arsenio Hall moment last night, if you ever saw David Letterman.
Really?
Yeah. You know, they were clowning around, and he allowed Letterman to mess up his hair. And all it takes is a little thing like that, like Clinton playing the saxophone on Arsenio Hall.
Right, I remember it well.
That was a turning point for his election.
And so Edwards let him muss his hair?
Yeah, you know, just rubbed his hand through his hair and let him mess it up, you know. And you know, it's between that and the fact that, you know, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton just... Well, I thought you did it so well with the, you know, dog sounds, which is true. That's what it was. A cat and dog fight.
It was so juvenile.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah, well, that's what I said at the time. It's embarrassing. So.
You know,
no, go ahead.
Well, like I said, you know, I'm going to vote for whoever wins the primary come election day, but I'm still behind Edwards 100% because it's all, to me, the message he's saying, that's what matters. You know, I don't, to me, Barack Obama, you know, they're all clubhouse politicians and they've all kind of, and Hillary Clinton, they all, you know, it's about the power. And again, don't get me wrong about Obama. You know, as an African-American male, I'm very proud of the fact that some of us are getting into the club.
Yeah, sure.
I guess in its own twisted way, that's progress in America. You know, but the reality is, you know, as far as my interests and my, what I want seeing and the direction that I want this country to go in, it's John Edwards.
As far as I can tell, me too. Now, I heard Mark Levine a few minutes ago saying he just thinks that John Edwards' day has race has run, his sun has set, and his day, you know, day is done. I don't. I don't at all. Because as long as the Bickersons keep up this business of sniping at each other, and frankly, the Clintons will keep sniping because that's how they politic. And that puts Senator Obama in the position of having to snipe back.
Well, you see, the thing is, that's not always a bad thing. Because you know what? I don't, because you know what? That's what the Republicans do. And the Clintons know that game. And you know, the Clintons, at the end of the day, can't stand up to someone like a Karl Rove. because you know that machine is going to be grinding up once after the Tuesday.
Well, the Clintons are already running, and you know, we talk about the Clintons. Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton, is already running an ad, I think, in South Carolina that basically says it just, well, you know, it uses, it's the whole Reagan thing all over again. And
which was?
Well, you know, the business about, you know, Barack Obama said Republicans had all the good ideas. Barack Obama says that Republicans were the party of change. Barack Obama said, and so just, put, you know, pulling all of that out of whole cloth. And it's an attack ad.
Well, also, you know,
it's a 60-second ad, Kevin, that is used not to tout what Senator Clinton can positively do to help the nation, but rather all the bad things about Senator Obama, and that's a confession, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't know, but to me, it's like it's the same that what they're doing to Obama. Because I was talking to a colleague today at work, and she swore Barack Obama is a Muslim. This is how.
And it was unshakable, wasn't it? I mean, you couldn't. Yeah.
Exactly. I told her no. Absolutely not.
But well, that's what that email said.
Yeah, exactly. She got that email.
Lord, do you realize? And did she get around to telling you that he took the oath of office on the Quran?
No, I stopped it right there, and I said, no, he did not take the oath of office on the Quran. He took it on the Bible. You're confusing him with that congressman from Minnesota.
But the thing is, you cannot unring a bell.
Exactly.
And I would like to think, and I'm pretty sure most of this stuff is generated by the right wing, because I started seeing it on right wing websites months ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, again, the right wing, and I refer to my Star Wars literature that the dark side never rests.
Right.
Hillary Clinton is the Democrat they can deal with the most. I don't think they can deal with Barack Obama, because I think Barack Obama, they don't even want him at this point, because I think he is so articulate, in spite of his name and his skin color, will appeal to a lot of people who normally wouldn't vote for an African American, and that really sinks at their craw.
Well, I imagine there's a lot of things that bother, and I'm speculating now. If I were Senator Clinton, I would be upset at this whole process, because this year was supposed to be her coronation.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody was supposed to get out of her way.
Yeah.
And I don't know, if she gets past South Carolina and does well in Super Tuesday, it may be over at that point.
Oh, yeah. Well, Super Tuesday is that's it. It is it, because think about it. Who? You know, it's how many states on Super Tuesday?
Oh, mercy. 20 or more?
And the thing is, the two heavy hitting states, New York and California, are on Super Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
You know what more? Need I say more? And I really do think, though, that Barack Obama's been backed by a lot of right wing money just to put a stump on the Clinton machine.
Well, I don't know about that, Kevin, because. I can see from what I do wading around in the right wing filth, just to see what the other side is thinking. Those people are aching to run against Hillary Clinton. They want to run against her worse than they wanted to run against John Kerry. They're dying to. They have poured millions and millions of dollars and man hours into building a machine that can not just defeat, but crush and utterly destroy her. They started building the machine in 1991, Kevin, and they've built on it every year since.
But I think Barack Obama has been there, because in any other year or any other time, this man would not, I don't care. I just don't, and this is why, again, and I'm probably going to get some hate mail from some African-Americans via you, Bob, is that I cannot take him seriously because, for the most part, Mid-America doesn't take us seriously. And that's who you have to appeal to.
But, well, wait a minute. Not if you're a Democratic campaign strategist. If you're a Democratic campaign strategist, you campaign, and John Edwards brought this up in the pageant two nights ago. If you're a Democratic campaign strategist, you campaign in the general election to win New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Oregon, Washington, California, and Florida. And you tell the rest of the country to go to hell.
Yeah, well,
that was the Kerry strategy. That was the Gore strategy. And it is the ongoing Democratic strategy. Because they've conceded Middle America.
It has failed miserably. I just think I cannot, again, and you know, my little adventure in Middle America, and this is why I say probably the reason why Barack Obama is getting so much money, a lot of it is coming from the right wing, because they want to make sure Hillary is well bloodied and bruised.
Okay, that part, yeah, that part I can see. That part I can see.
Okay.
But please bear in mind, you say they failed, but the definition of insanity is repeating the same act over and over again, Kevin, expecting a different result. And for the most part, Democratic campaign strategy has been insane. Now, I know we won in 2000, and odds are we won in 2004. We were beaten by the machines.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the machines can't come into play unless you're already conceding a certain portion of the country.
Yeah. Well, I think the hope is the Southwest. Look out for Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico. Those states are... and Colorado. Those four states are turning incredibly blue, and those four states are a toss-up. That's the region you need to look out for this coming election.
And, well, I've done some reading on places like Montana. Yeah, absolutely. That's shifting away from...
I think Montana still has a long way to go. But particularly in the Southwest, Nevada, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico. New Mexico is already blue.
Yeah, yeah. Kevin, good to talk to you. I've got to roll along the top of the hour and all of that stuff. But, you're very well spoken and very well said on all of this. I'm just curious, you know, for every one of those people that you talked to today, you know, did you know he's a Muslim? How many millions more are there?
Oh, I don't even want to comprehend. I don't even want to think about it.
You know, it's kind of like cockroaches. When you see one, you know you've got a million.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not promising. And they're going to wear that out. And remember, you know, Fox invented this.
Of course.
Fox invented it, CNN debunked it, and Fox kept on talking about it even after it was debunked. Now it's made its way into a viral email.
Exactly.
And you've got Barack Obama sunk all the way to the point of having to appear on the Christian Broadcasting Network to try to get people, please quit saying I'm a Muslim. I'm not a Muslim.
Well, the thing is, Barack Hussein Obama.
Oh yeah, and they say that like that. They
say alone.
Yeah, well, they say the thing is that's a calculated thing too, Kevin. They say the right wing says Barack Hussein Obama the way they say John Wilkes Booth.
And also communist China.
yeah. The people that we demonize, we always use their full name. The guy who shot John Lennon, Mark David Chapman. The guy who shot Lincoln, John Wilkes Booth. Lee Harvey Oswald, Barack Hussein Obama. It's the same thing. It's the same treatment.
He's going through his stuff. Orenthal, James Simpson.
There you go.
Well, no OJ.
Yeah, Orenthal.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, you can see the strategy. You know what they're up to.
Yeah. Exactly. Anytime they mention all three names.
Yep. So just, you know, just remember that. Have a good night, Kevin. Good talking to you.
You too.
Bye. All right, let's take a little break. Just get away for a couple of minutes. I will remind you that we are a listener-supported endeavor, a listener-supported effort. We've been trying to raise this month the princely sum of $3,000. It is the 23rd day of January, and we haven't gotten to $1,000 yet. If you can, please help. This is America's Liberal Voice. This is The Horn. We'll be right back.
You want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
If you can stand it, I can. Play it.
Howdy, Rangers. Tune into Rick's Place. You'll be fascinated with porn psychotherapist Rick Goodner's take on all of today's political issues from a real Texan's liberal point of view. So mosey on into Rick's Place for some good old hospitality with Rick Goodner. See you there, Rangers, this Saturday, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn. And if you want another kind of love,
Rick's Place with Rick Goodner, part of the weekend lineup on The Horn, running all weekend in rotation with The Showers Report and Night Sounds.
Listen, man, adding fractions is no big deal.
Nah?
Nah. You just gotta find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4, and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers, so that becomes an 8, too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher. But without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're Head On with Bob Kincaid.
Okay, and the promo there for Rick's Place reminds me that I don't say enough, I don't do enough, I don't remind folks enough that there is original programming on the weekends on The Horn. Let me take a moment to do that. We have three excellent programs that run in rotation from Saturday night all the way into early Monday. We have the Sowards Report, featuring America's youngest liberal talk team. Young and smart, I might add. Matt Sowards and his intrepid producer, Devin Swartz. We have Night Sounds, a three-hour musical journey in which you can kick back and relax and put, you know, get out of the swamp for a while and dry off. That's what Night Sounds is about. Not being all just covered up in the political filth and ooze. Being able to relax and remember that there's something enjoyable about this sweet, all-too-brief existence on this tiny little blue-green marble hurtling through the universe. And then Rick's Place with horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner. As refreshing and straightforward a bit of straight shooting as you're likely to come across anywhere in America. Deconstructing right-wing Republican insanity into tiny, tiny, tiny units. And, you know, professionally pointing up the crazies and saying, see those over there? They're not good for you. They're not good for us. They're part of the problem, not part of the solution. So, by all means, check out the weekend schedule on The Horn, beginning Saturday evenings at 6 p.m. And a lot of us are there in the chat room, headonradionetwork.com. Join in. I think you'd enjoy it. So, that's a little bit about that's our weekends. We never sleep. Quick update. Just reading the headline here. House Democrats will postpone votes on criminal contempt citations against White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton and former White House Counsel Harriet Myers. postpone votes on criminal contempt. You heard me. While congressional leaders work with George Bush on a bipartisan stimulus package to fend off an economic downturn. That according to party leaders and leadership aides. The folks over at BuzzFlash editorialized to say, one party preaches bipartisanship while kicking the other party in the groin, and one party hobbles around Congress on knee pads. Guess which one the Democrats are? Yep. Instead of using the Bolton and the Myers contempt issue, which is a legitimate issue, you know, telling Congress to take its congressional subpoena and stick it where the sun doesn't shine, you know, because, you know, we don't, you know, badges, we don't need the stinking badges. Instead of using that as an issue to keep this from being another corporate tax giveaway, this so-called stimulus package, God almighty, why does the Congress keep enabling these bastards? That's not a rhetorical question. I don't have a legitimate answer for it. Why does the Congress keep enabling the Bush administration? Oh, okay, you want us to prop you up so it'll look like everything only went to crap when you left office, George? Okay, we can do that. Zip. Sure, George, be happy to accommodate you any way we can. You know, Mark Levine did a very good job in his program earlier talking about the most profound sorts of stimulus. And I'd never thought of it in these terms, but it made perfect sense. He said the best way to the most immediate economic stimulus you can have is to increase food stamps, because lower class people go and buy stuff with it immediately, and it bolsters the business that sell food as well as the businesses that produce food. It goes immediately, just, you know, boom, like a shot of adrenaline right into the economy. Whereas if you give $1 million to Bill Gates puts it in the bank and it starts gathering dust and does nothing for the economy. But what are we going to get in the form of this stimulus package? I have a feeling this stimulus package is going to be the political version of a nice little rock of meth. Oh, we'll get rid of the death tax. Oh, we'll give money to corporate America because corporate America is really hurting. This is the welfare state. But it's not the welfare of working people that is being attended to. Oh, we're going to mail everybody $800. Horse feathers. That $800 isn't going to do any good. I mean, if you want to give away money and make it count, send every working American who makes less than $60,000 a year $5,000. That's a level where it might start helping. Because $800 is, for somebody who has a commute to work every day, that's gas money now. So in other words, so why not just give the money directly to ExxonMobil and say to hell with it? God, I can hear the CEO of ExxonMobil now. Well, I like that one, Bob. By golly, I think you've hit on something. Yeah, just give us the money. To hell with you people. Well, that's a good idea there, Bob. You want us to get you an honorary degree in conservative economics there, Bob? Economic stimulus. Economic dodge job, economic cover-up, economic fudge, economic fraud, economic scam, faked up, dummied up, ginned up, rubed up garbage. And instead of doing the people's business and attending to criminal conduct on the part of members of the Bush administration, instead of doing that, why, we're going to put everything on hold while we let George Bush write a Republican Party campaign commercial check to the American electorate. Remember when they gave away the $300 advance? And it came with letters from the Internal Revenue Service. Hi, I'm George W. Bush. You need more of your money. I've directed the IRS to send you, the Treasury Department, to send you some money, because I, George W. Bush, President of the United States, love you bunches. Hugs and kisses! Well, that's what'll happen here, too. This is pathetic. And the lack of any kind of vision or prescience being shown by the Democratic majorities in Congress is utterly and completely stunning. What, Bob? He's going to use this to further his own political ends for his own political party? Oh, now, Bob, you're just jaded. You're a cynic. They'd never do something like that. And then the envelopes go out with, you know, big red letters on bordered in blue on a white envelope. A gift to you from the Republican Party. And it's going to happen. And I'm going to scream when it does. Because sometimes screaming is all you got left. To the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Robert in Japan.
Hey, Robert, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Okay. I have to disagree with you on that last point that you were making about the getting $5,000 and making that as a big change.
Yeah.
The reason being is that I think, as one commentator said, all Americans would do is just spend the money on more imported goods, which would raise the trade deficit, and it wouldn't really help American manufacturing. So it's not about consumption. I think it's about productivity by getting, jobs back in America.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. And that's why the business with, like, food stamps makes so much sense, because there's at least a chance that that will go into the American economy as opposed to the economy, the overseas economy of, China and whatnot.
Right. I mean, the dynamics of what's going on is just so screwed up. I was just taking a look at Krugman's blog and the Economist, and he was pointing out, there's just so many fundamentals that are just, they're so messed up that it's going to be really hard to get out of it. And I think that your listeners got to realize that, recessions can go on for a very long time.
Yes, they can. The Asian recession went on forever, didn't it?
Well, hell, I came to Japan in, 94? Yeah, 94, and the recession had already been in for like 3-4 years by then, because the bubble had burst. And, it didn't stop until like 2 years ago, perhaps. So it's been going on for like 12 years. And they've had interest rates down to almost zero. So 0.1, 0.2. I get maybe 0.2% on my bank account savings.
Wow.
So, I mean, once you get down to that level, it gets into like, well, what else can we do with the free market? Because that's it.
Yeah.
And,
But again, just to sort of reiterate my point, when you're monkeying with all of that stuff, you're proving that it's not a free market.
Exactly, right. And so, I mean, the Japanese government would just pop in money and give subsidies, and that became like a kind of like an addiction, because the companies wanted more and more and more. And so all the cities in Japan owe billions of dollars on top of what the nation of Japan owes. I think Japan has the highest debt ratio of all countries in the world. I mean, perhaps, I don't know about Zimbabwe, maybe some African countries, like Zimbabwe have more, but I mean, the currency is really a joke, but nobody wants to say it's a joke, because everyone, if you say it's a joke, then everything goes to the crapper. So that's pretty much what I think is happening in the States too. I saw that on one economy blog, I can't remember which one, said the return rate for the United States savings now, it's like the third from the bottom. The dollar's weakening. So if the United States economy is held up by borrowing from foreigners, then foreigners are going to be less likely to give, and so I don't see any way out of it. Unless you raise taxes and raise interest rates to pay off the debt to make the currency sounder, or and then start raising interest rates to get people to get back into, you know, putting investing in this, in America. Yeah, I don't see that happening. I don't see that happening with any of these candidates at all. I'm going to raise taxes. I'm going to raise interest rates. I don't see it.
Oh, raising taxes is a third rail. That's the surest way to make sure that you are no longer considered a viable candidate.
So it's kind of like a drunk saying, I need more alcohol, you know, for me to get better. I just,
Right. Yeah. You need to sober up. Well, I will just as quick as you give me a drink.
That's right. So lower those interest rates some more. I mean, this is, and so it's like they've chosen the poison pill of inflation, which is really going to, you know, bite Americans on the butt in a couple more weeks and months to come. And I just don't see any pleasant way out of this mess at all. I mean, if a Democrat does get elected, you know, it would be the same thing like they did to Jimmy Carter, you know.
Sure. And today, you know, I watched the market today, and it finished up by, like, what, 128 points, the Dow Jones did. And all of a sudden, it's, oh, well, we're all well again. Okay.
Yeah.
All better now.
Sure. Yeah, until tomorrow.
And it's cheating. Right now, what we're seeing on the market is cheating, propping up phony baloney economics. But that's the point. It doesn't matter what happens to the American people, Robert. I mean, let's just be square. If no one else will be straight with each other, let's be straight with each other. It does not matter what happens to working people. It does not matter what happens to single moms. It does not matter what happens to babies in the cradle. Okay? Right now, we are, to use a chess analogy, we are in an end game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's well put, I think. But, yeah, I think the end game, I mean, it has to come, because I don't see, even if Hillary got elected or any of the other Democrats, I don't think they would actually, it would take so much time to actually make the difference for the poor people. And to actually have poor people actually have more money in their pocket at the end of the day on the free market, still using the free market system as it is, I'm skeptical, you know. And so I think we just need to hit bottom. I mean, really hit bottom before real change happens, just like we did in the 1930s. You know, we didn't have real change until we hit bottom. So,
and
this is a good thing.
Yeah, but the thing, what does, and this is not a rhetorical question, Robert. What does hitting bottom look like?
That's a good question, because I was going to ask you the question. What is the difference between a recession and a depression? I mean, when can we say a depression hit? You know, because, you know, they were arguing, well, we're not in a recession yet, and, you know, they were debating that.
Oh, if we got to whatever it is we finally get around to defining the bottom as, if we get there, Robert, we're not going to be allowed to call that a depression.
No, of course not. Right.
It's, again, it is perception management, image management, language management. The worst it will be called is a very deep recession.
Right.
Because George W. Bush and the Republican Party and its godforsaken policies cannot ever be deemed to have been the cause of a depression. Even though this and the market crash of 87 and, of course, the great crash of 29 were all driven by Republican fiscal policies. They cannot be held to account. They cannot be allowed to be made to be personally responsible. It is simply not done. I'd like to hear a bunch of people chime in on that question. What does a bottoming out look like? What does it feel like? What happens? Because the people who could answer that question are gone for the most part. Even the people who were children during the Great Depression, like my father, are mostly gone. You know, my father was 5 years old when the Depression hit, and he was 18 years old when he went in the United States Navy in 1943. He can only, you know, that generation, what I'm getting at, can only give us a child's eye view.
Right. Well, it's a sad thing because, you know, eventually it's going to come around and bite you on the butt, and your wife or your husband will turn to you and say, what are we going to do when you don't have a job? And or your children will ask you, what am I going to do with my life? And people don't seem to be thinking more deeply about this, you know. I get the shivers thinking about it. If I was tossed over.
Believe you me, it's terrifying to me because I don't have anybody to look to and say, you know, how did you guys get through this? Because, again, back then, at least, you know, what jobs there were American jobs. You know, there was, in this region, you know, there were the mines. But beyond that, there was the CCC and the WPA, because you had the Roosevelt administration in there who said, you know, look, we'll build some state parks. We'll make trails. We'll do something. But we're going to put America to work again, and we're going to give America, because people define themselves by their ability to be productive and be meaningful, especially men. And that was critical at that point in time. We don't have anybody who thinks that any of that is a viable alternative. Even though some of the smartest people in the country are saying that that's what desperately needs to be happening, a vital, determined return to the rebuilding of our infrastructure.
Well, they were even saying, I think maybe it was on Lou Dobbs. I was just keeping the TV on for no good reason, was saying that even the crown jewels of the American industry, going over pharmaceuticals and naming off some other ones, semiconductors, had all lost manufacturing jobs in a serious ass way to China, and so there's no more good jobs left. So I was thinking, you know, McCain was saying, well, we have to look for other jobs, and when he was campaigning in Michigan, I was like, well, what other jobs are there? You know, it's like the Mexican. When I went to Mexico, I lived on the Texas border back in 95 during the Reagan years as a volunteer teacher. And, having traveled to Mexico more like, you know, 7-8 times, it's kind of like what's happening there is happening to the States, where there's just nothing there. There's no more industries. All you have left is handicraft, and you're eating dirt. So, you know, sending your kids to college doesn't make any sense because why? There's no jobs to be had. So it's going to be a real psychological depression as well, I think.
And the one thing I remember hearing from my mom, my dad, my grandparents is there wasn't any money.
Right, no money. So I don't know. I just I don't see any good happy way out of this. I mean, unless they start making some tough choices and biting the bullet and you know doing things the hard way, raising taxes here and there, paying off the debt, you know, to make the currency worth anything, and then trying to get and stopping these goddamn trade agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA and all the other 100 ones that they signed, and even then it's going to take years to get your factories back.
Sure. And meanwhile, I got to work and see if I can get David K. Johnston on this program. It'll take me a couple of days, but I got to see if I can get him here because. One of the things that I've seen in reading his stuff is that, you know, the uber rich squirrel their money away and it does nothing. It just lays there.
Right.
Frankly, if what Mark Levine said earlier was true, and I take it to be true, that if you want to stimulate the economy, you give it to people who have none and they spend it.
Right.
Then it stands to reason that you've got to redistribute some wealth from the people who have their long short-term debentures and their coupon clipping and yada yada yada. That some of that needs to be put into the economy, forcefully or voluntarily. But it needs to get working.
Needs to get working. I mean, it's the old the big picture. I mean, the Americans don't see really the big picture. I mean, China is now becoming very, very rich. They just opened up their new maglev train system. So they didn't want to go to just the regular bullet train system. They wanted the next generation system where the trains run on magnets. And so that, they've done that already. And if you look at some of the cities in China now, they're really beautiful.
Meanwhile, others, you can't see the foot in front of your face because of the coal smoke.
Right, and the train's still a second world, and, you know, well, yeah, it's the United States is slowly moving from first world to second world, and people don't really realize how bad it is. I mean, even when I traveled through California, I mean, once I left San Francisco all the way down to Los Angeles, I traveled through territory that I thought was third damn world, honestly.
Just pathetic,
you know, little trailer parks, little villages and towns that, you know, were dependent on crappy little industries, and there's just nothing there. And this is California. But, you know, everyone thinks California is such a beautiful, rich little state and, you know, the land of milk and honey. It ain't. I mean, once you leave, and even San Francisco when I was there, there was lots of homeless people out in the streets begging. And this was like 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, but we know now by listening to Bill O'Reilly that homeless people choose to be homeless because they're drunk, drug-addicted, insane people.
Yeah. Same attitudes as we have here in Japan. So, I mean, once you're homeless, it's like it's the kiss of death because it's very hard to get out of it again. Because, I mean, even when I told you that story about the time of the church when I... There was a homeless man right outside the church, and I said, I want to give him some noodle soup. And the church lady said, oh, don't you do that. Don't you do that. We got into a little back and forth on it. And they said, if you get that noodles, you have to say it's from you and not from the church. And so each time I see the homeless person, I say it's from me and not from the church. Because they didn't want any more homeless people. They just wanted their little rituals and their crackers and their coffee and eat outside when homeless people start to death. And he did die. I went to the priest and I said, look, I mean, the bowl of soup is good for him, but what about tomorrow? So I offered to pay him $200 a month until we got this guy reformed. And he refused. I said, what about your son? He ain't doing nothing. No. Didn't want to go out to the convenience store just to buy the bento, the lunchbox for him. Just, you know, he couldn't be bothered with it. And that's the state of religion today.
That's heartbreaking. I'm stunned just to hear that.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons I left, you know, because...
The poor you have always with ye. What's one more or less?
And my rituals are far more important than this, and... And so when I complained about it, they said I was being too judgmental.
At which point you show them your back and, you know, and never again your front.
What's the point, you know, because if giving the magic cracker, not receiving it, but giving it for decades upon decades doesn't make you into a better person, what's the point of the damn cracker, right? And what's the point of you being a holy person if you can't have a little compassion for someone that's starving on your doorstep? So, as you said, organized religion is dead.
Well, and it's deadly.
Deadly, yeah. Well put. And with that, I have to go off to work, my friend.
Well, a very happy work day to you, and it's always good hearing from you, Robert.
Okay, be in touch.
All right, bye now. Our good friend Robert off to the start of his day in Kitakyushu, Japan. I just noticed this. I saw this in the chat room. And you guys have a beautiful way of sort of making things make elegant sense. ELO, Queen of the Moderators. Notes, so how come there isn't $35 billion over 5 years for S-CHIP, but there's $145 billion for right now to save Shrub's ass? I'm glad you guys asked those kinds of questions. because most people aren't asking those kinds of questions. The S-chip bill was a bad idea because it moved people toward government insurance instead of private insurance where they belong, so that when they have to have a new liver, their private insurance company can tell them to go pound sand and die. Because that's the free market at work. The free market can solve all our problems. $145 billion in economic stimulus that we don't need. That we don't need. It's you realize this economic stimulus plan, whether we send every American $800 or send every American $800,000, it doesn't matter, because the check is hot. It's rubber. Oh, you can hand the check to your bank and they'll give you back some of those, you know, some money. They'll hand you $800, $100 bills. But God Almighty, it's going to a loan shark. Does Congress even begin to comprehend how much that $800 is actually going to cost ordinary Americans? Hey, Congress, here's an idea. End the stinking Iraqupation, and you won't have to write the $145 billion hot check, because we won't be throwing that money down that rat hole anymore. Makes my head hurt. We used to have a running gag in our family. Dad and I would go to the car lot and look around. We were inveterate car lot look-arounders. I'd say, hey, Dad, come look at this. He'd say, how much is it? I'd say, $52,000. And he'd look at me and go, hell, boy, write a check. It was a gag. But what was a gag inside my family is apparently reality on Capitol Hill. They just make money up. Call over to South Korea and have them print us some more money. $145 billion economic stimulus package. How long did it take us? I mean, this is a serious question. Answer me in the chat room or email or whatever. How long does it take us to spend $145 billion in Iraq? Month? 2 months? Three? You know, it reminds me of the very well-meaning people, and I'm not being an ass about this, the very well-meaning people who keep telling me, you know, come on, Bob, you can quit smoking. And I can, and I will. But some of them say, you know, look, take the money that you would spend on cigarettes and put it in a box. And at the end of the year, look at all the money you'll have. And it's true. It'd be probably something on the order of $5,000. That's stunning. But it would. And it's a good reason. And it's a good example. So, you know, let's take the example of the save the money you get from not smoking and just save it for a year and then see where you are. Let's apply that to the Iraqupation. You want to stimulate the economy, end the stupid war. End the Iraqupation. Unfortunately, that is not a, what? That's not a popular idea with our betters on Wall Street and K Street and Capitol Hill. In fact, today, appearing on NBC on, I believe, the Today Show, General David Petraeus, Savior of the Universe. Well, he took a little bit of the starch out of people like Joe Medem Lieberman and John Let's Stay in Iraq 100 Years McCain, who said things as far back as November as, we've succeeded militarily. And Lieberman out there prattling around saying, we are winning because we've made progress in one of the most remarkable turnarounds in modern military history. Well, apparently, Savior of the Universe David Petraeus doesn't see it that way.
But the top U.S. military commanders remain cautious. They say Iraq has not yet reached a turning point, and that without continued American support, the security gains could be lost.
We think we won't know that we've reached a turning point until we're 6 months past it.
Huh? What, Edith? Let's hear that again, sports fans.
Lost.
We think we won't know that we've reached a turning point until we're 6 months past it. We have repeatedly said that there's no lights at the end of the tunnel that we're seeing. We're certainly not dancing in the end zone or anything like that.
Do you think the insurgents, the militias, are just waiting out the surge?
There may be some who are, but certainly...
This is the Bob is going to start screaming in a minute portion of the program. We may not know we've reached the turning point until we're 6 months past it. We may not know that we've gotten to the exit ramp to Grandma's house until we're 6 miles past it, too. Oh, hell, we missed the exit. Ah, darn, 6 months ago we had a chance to end this whole nightmare, and now it's blowing back up in our face. Rats, I guess we'll have to stay for another 6 months. This 6 months, of course, is the ubiquitous six-month Freedman unit. It'll take us 6 months. We need another 6 months. We're turning the corner in 6 months. 6 months should tell us what we need to know about the surge. Didn't this freak sit in Congress not too awfully long back, like, you know, 6 months ago, and say, we need another 6 months? 6 months should tell us if the surge is surging. Well, okay, 6 months later, and we get that. We won't know if we've surged our surge until our surge has surged past the six-month surge mark. And then we'll need 6 months to know if we were right the 6 months before about the previous 6 months. Maresy dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy divey, a kiddly divey too, wouldn't you?
The Al-Qaeda and related insurgents, most of those are not. They don't have that luxury.
Jesus, this is Richard Mulligan in Little Big Man standing at the top of the Little Big Horn as Custer screaming, "Mr. President, you're drunk." No one countermands a Custer decision. I'll know in 6 months if I was a genius 6 months ago. Because it's the nature of my genius. It's a 6 month genius period. Jesus. No economic stimulus plan for the United States, because the United States does not have the common good sense to realize that when you're setting fire to billions of dollars a month in a bloody hole in the sand called Iraq, that anything else that you do is lipstick on a pig. Oh, mother. Let's try the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Oh, okay. This is Cindy, Bob, here in Washington.
Hey, Cindy, how are you?
Hey, I'm fine. I'm the one that's preparing for a depression out here, so I thought I'd call in and tell you how you can tell when we're in a depression.
Okay, please. I sincerely want to know.
Okay. One of the first dead giveaways is you go to the grocery store to get your food, and you start noticing a whole bunch of empty shelves. And that's because the suppliers are starting to go belly up. And the truck drivers go belly up because they can't bring it in and keep the truck running because it costs a high fuel. And as more and more and more people belly up, it's like daisy chains, and that grocery store gets empty. And when it gets real empty, you go to get your groceries and it's locked and there's no more grocery store open in your neighborhood.
You know,
what are you going to do? There's no food.
It's very interesting, Cindy, that you would bring that up, because I wondered if I was just being a little bit paranoid. But I pay attention to this kind of thing when I go through the store, because I'm one of these people who reads labels and looks at shelves and pays attention to brands based on the quality of the ingredients and all of that stuff. And I started noticing 4, 5, 6 months ago, maybe longer, that I couldn't get stuff in the grocery store that I used to be able to get. Now, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, big-ticket items or luxury gourmet items like, you know, pickled hummingbird tongues or anything like that, but just ordinary, boring stuff. It just wasn't there, and the shelves were empty, and there was this gap on the shelf. And you'd look, and there's the little tag that said, you know, mushroom stems and pieces, but there weren't any mushroom stems and pieces there.
Yeah, that's your high sign. And when you see your grocery store looking like that, and this is my suggestion to anyone listening, take your grocery money, you go down and you hit every store in your neighborhood for the lowest price possible, and you start putting beans and rice and stuff that'll last a long time dry on the shelves. You start stocking your cupboards like that, because when a depression hits, not only is there a run on the bank, there's a run on the grocery store. And then there's nothing left, and the grocery stores go belly up, and the people in the cities start getting hungry. Do you remember when Russia fell and there was no food?
Yeah.
1992 that happened?
Early 90s, yeah.
Yeah. And there's a couple of films out there on the Internet about how bad it got in Russia. People were out in the streets hungry, bundled up, you know, wishing anybody would help them. And when a depression hits, the name of the game, this is how it works. You wake up in the morning and your first thought is, how am I going to feed myself today? How am I going to feed my children? And your whole day's occupation is taken up in trying to find the next meal. And it's really tough.
Well, Cindy, what I find interesting out of this analysis that you're and it's very sound, is that if there are no groceries on the shelves, it doesn't matter how much money you have in your pocket.
Well, yeah, that's true. But one thing you will notice with empty grocery stores, you'll notice that some of the restaurants survive, and it's the one where the very rich people go to. And they will come out and eat at the restaurants, and then when they start seeing people watching them eat through the windows, they go back home and start having house parties again.
Is that where we're headed?
That's what happens. We're going right into it, Bob. I'm telling you, that's why I bought this place and set it up, because I saw it coming. It's been 15 years I've been here now, and I saw it coming under Bush number one. And I decided to get out of Los Angeles and move into the country where I could defend myself against starvation, because I'm one of the lucky people that was taught tooth and nail how to survive a depression by my grandparents and my parents, all of whom survived the depression. And instead of going out to the rock and roll concerts and having a good time with all the others, I was at home taking notes and getting training how to cook from scratch, how to put things up, how to make homemade soup, how to farm my garden so that I can feed myself. I learned all those talents that it's going to take, and I collected every book and how-to, so I have a whole library to teach my neighbors how to do this. So when the day comes and the proverbial stuff hits the fan, I'm going to be able to help my community quite a bit to rebound and survive.
Well, what you say about the cities is so very, very true, Cindy, And people like you have got to be there to pass this knowledge along, but our cities can't feed themselves. And I think we had a good bit of this conversation last night in John Fox's program, based on an article from the New York Times over the past weekend about the rising cost of food of cooking oil, and. we don't get the reporting on it. There are already food riots in the so-called third world. Egypt has stopped the export of its rice because it can't feed its people. There have been wheat riots in Pakistan.
I know, and it's going to get worse. And in the cities, there's not going to be any clean water. No.
Yeah.
The cities are going to go down first because they're the most vulnerable. I don't know where those people are going to go. I don't know where they'll go when in order to survive the city, they have to decide that they're not going to cut each other up, that they're going to hold hands and work their way out of it, you know, or a lot of them are going to die.
But that's not human nature, is it, Cindy?
I think that we have a lot better people in our country than we're counting on. I think that we've been focused on the bad part of our humanity for the last 8 years that have been in charge of this place. They're the thieves that come around every time the pot gets full to steal it. You notice how every time they come back into office, it's because the pot got full?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. How big was the surplus that had been that had been generated in the Clinton administration? And
I think it was $4 trillion, if I remember.
And how many months did it? Months, not years. How many months did it take George Bush to zero that out and run it into a negative number, even without 9/11 having happened yet or the Iraq War? Remember,
by the first summer.
Yeah, he had zeroed out a $4 trillion surplus in the space of 5 short months.
Do you remember that story I sent you from the 4th of July of 2001? Now, that would be before 9/11. The 4th of July is a holiday weekend when everybody was gone on holiday. And all the banks were closed and all the schools were closed and everyone was on vacation. And here came this gigantic, it was hundreds of billions of dollars. I think $700 billion and change moved out of the USA through the Bank of America into a foreign account in the British Isles. And the thing that happened was it tripped through the wrong lady's bank account. And she saw that number on her statement and about fell through the floor and called her bank, and they got it straightened out and it belonged to somebody else. But I noted the name of the bank, where it came from, where it went. You know, it was transferred by Bank of America offshore to the British Isles on the 4th of July. Who needed that kind of money when the banks are closed?
Nobody but a bank robber.
Yeah, tell me about it. And I couldn't get anybody interested in that story. These people are actually, this Bush crime family is actually a syndicate of criminals, just like the Genovese family, just like the Corleone pretend family of the Godfather.
Oh yeah, they're the Kenny Bunkport Cosa Nostra.
Yeah, they're a real Cosa Nostra for real. And we prefer to pretend they're not so that we can hold our heads up in polite society. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm no part of them, and I'll hold my head up and call a state anytime. That's who they are, and that's what we got running our country, and that's how come we're going under again. And I don't care if they give us another Reagan, I'll throw pancakes at him too, because he was part of this.
Sure he was.
They've been robbing us a long time. We were a very wealthy country, and they just finished shaking it down. And they've shaken down the spenders. They keep saying that this economy has to have people going to the store to keep it going, that we're all a bunch of shoppers. Well, guess what? We're all tapped. We don't have any money to shop with anymore.
Yeah, all shopped out.
We're all shopped out. Everybody's broke. I know people that have college educations that are out on the street, homeless, going from shelter to shelter for food. I know lots of good people like that, family people that were homeowners and had careers and retirement packages just 5 years ago. You know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank. And they lose their job. They use their retirement to try to pay off their debts and live on it. And and it's been ground down over the years. Of, you know, this has been almost 8 years of being robbed, and everybody's down to where they don't have any more to get robbed with, and they're out of money. And, you know, it's really, really horrifying. And the young people, they saved money on the coming Social Security payout by throwing anybody 55 and older out of a job. That way they could lower your annual income for the last 10 working years of your life. And when you go...
And short sheet you on your Social Security.
Right. When you go to apply for Social Security, you get a much smaller check than you would have had if you were making $20 an hour or whatever that they laid you off from. So anybody over 55 is forced back to $10 an hour. And that's nationwide, Bob, nationwide. So our generation, after we took care of our grandparents who did not have Social Security yet, we helped support them with our paychecks when we were really young. And then there was our parents who had Social Security, but it wasn't quite enough. And they still needed money for things like hearing aids and special shoes and wheelchairs because those aren't covered by insurance or Medicare. So we had to still supply that to our parents, plus help pay the growing property taxes on their homes and to keep their homes in good repair because they couldn't afford the escalating price of home maintenance. So we kept up, the money kept going out to take care of that generation, and then came our children who needed to go to college, and we jettisoned our future cash and went into debt to put the kids into college. And now what's our thanks? A $10 job at the local store, and we're supposed to be able to retire in 10 years, and the kids are all out with their college education playing on ATVs and motorcycles, and they got boats and fancy cars and nice homes. And they're all saying, thanks, Dad, enjoy the poorhouse. And that's what's happening in America.
And it is. You've painted a portrait. And frankly, all those funsters, you know, when the time comes, you do get to look at them, because I take you back to what we said. You know, you can have all the money in the world, but if there ain't nothing on the shelves, you ain't buying anything. Eat your Sea-Doo. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think we're going to get the last laugh, because when this thing crashes, and it will, you know, right now it's being propped up by funny money. But there isn't enough funny money in the world to hold up this turkey, believe me. And when it comes rolling down, all those boys with their Sea-Doos are going to be awful hungry because they don't know how to cook.
And they know how to ride their Sea-Doos, but they can't stop them long enough to catch a damn fish.
Yeah, they don't know how to fish. They don't know how to hunt. They don't know how to raise chickens. They don't know how to grow a garden. They don't know how to can food or dry food or put things up for the winter. You know, I don't care what city you live in. You got to eat 12 months a year, and you got to be able to know how to grow your own food and put it up so that you'll have it months down the road and it won't rot. You know,
well, then, you know, I sit and I gripe sometimes, and I joke about, you know, I wish I lived in civilization. But it's conversations like this that make me cherish and value this little acre of ground all the more. I've got
right.
Something that's fairly rare in West Virginia. I've got an acre of flat ground.
Wow.
And I can, you know, I can raise a garden on it. I can put up a chicken coop. I mean, this acre of flat ground, once upon a time in my grandmother's era, this thing, they raised a beef steer every year. And then they had a couple of pigs every year. They had a chicken house, chicken coop year-round, so they had their eggs and their chicken on Sunday. And they gardened the rest of it.
Well, that's your future, Bob.
I don't disagree with you. I think there's a very strong likelihood that it's my future.
You have your own well?
Yes. Well, at least until the coal companies get done with it. We have about 4 explosions a day now, and I expect the water table to drop fairly soon, and my well will dry up.
Well, I think that you need to go to your legal people, your state senators and whatnot, and tell them that you desperately need to have protection, property rights protection over your well. You know,
that's a great idea, Cindy, and I'm not trying to be a pessimist, but I could go to my state senator or my member of the House of Delegates and tell them that, or I could go out to my backyard and say it to a rock. or a tree stump. It would have the same.
I've seen what happened to some of those people up in Appalachia over their wells. They lose their wells, and they open those taps to poisoned water. It's horrifying.
Yeah, it is.
It's horrifying.
Yeah, I'm looking in the chat room, and Nanette, who lives here in West Virginia too, says where the where the politics issue is concerned. She's I'm not kidding when I say that we have no political representation in this state. Now, if I was a mine owner, or if I was somebody who worked for a mountaintop removal company, I could go and get patted on the back and told hail fellow well met by all kinds of senators, Democrats and Republicans alike. But I'm just a little Joe out on a patch of ground, and I don't matter one iota to the elected representatives of this state.
I understand that. And I'll tell you, for all your listeners out there beyond West Virginia.
Yeah. Cindy? Darn. See what happens when we start talking hard truth close to home? You lose the phone call. Well, Cindy, do try to call back. I'll be here. We've got another caller on hold on waiting. Well, that person's not waiting anymore. So call back, Cindy. Little glimpses of reality sneak through from time to time. Headline from the Los Angeles Times. Now, this sort of dovetails with what I told you about last week, the lawsuit that got bounced by Alito, Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy. That would have held a couple of companies liable, along with the company that defrauded shareholders. That case got dumped, and as a consequence, this week, namely yesterday, the Supreme Court dismissed a huge lawsuit growing out of the Enron debacle. It was a lawsuit filed by shareholders attempting to hold responsible the banks who participated in the Enron Ponzi scheme, along with Enron and its predatory capitalists. The United States Supreme Court told those people to go pound sand. Let's see if we've got Cindy back. Hi, who have I got? Hello? Hello? Well, that's weird. The phones are getting a little hinky. This is depressing. The ruling is the most recent in a spate of decisions in which the courts have favored businesses. No, really? You're kidding. In dismissing the appeal of the Regents of the University of California versus Merrill Lynch, the court appeared to doom the big lawsuits still pending against Enron's bankers. The fix, as they say, is in. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's me calling back, Bob.
Hey, I hated losing you there, Cindy. Yeah, just 1 minute you were there, the next minute it was gone.
Yeah, I must have said something somebody didn't like, huh?
Yeah, I think you did. I think we did. I think every night we say a lot of things that people don't like, and it's a miracle we're still here.
I have a really good book to recommend, and it's called Depression Era Recipes.
Uh-huh.
And the person that wrote it is Patricia R. Wagner, W-A-G-N-E-R, Depression Era Recipes. And it's a really good book full of all kinds of things that you can make yourself at home and little quibs about life during the Depression. And I recommend it to put on anybody's shelf as a survival tool.
Okay. Is it a fairly recent book?
Yeah, it's very recent. I bought it on the internet. It's $9.95. Patricia Wagner is a freelance artist and writer. She lives on a small tree farm in Minnesota with her husband Robert and their two sons, Lee and Ryan. I got it at Amazon.com.
Okay, cool. You know, that, and when you were talking about having a lot of books on the shelf, I was thinking about the Foxfire books.
Huh?
You remember those?
Oh, yeah.
You know, country living and that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. I once told you that I'm a seventh generation granddaughter to Thomas Jefferson, right?
Right.
And one of his great loves was his library. And ever since I was a little child, before I ever even was told about the family background, I had this thing about collecting libraries, and I've done that all my life. And now that I'm, 56 years old, I've got a heck of a library put together here. And it's all history and how-to and interest. I've never been interested in love stories and stuff that people buy. I don't have anything like that. But if it's classic, like Dickens, I have all the classics. But this is all survival stuff, and basically it's what happened to America. It's all about our country, our rise and our fall, and everything about anything that ever happened to America is here in this library. I was convinced that these rich people were going to take over our libraries and destroy them, and that we would not have the true history of our country. So I've been collecting them since the mid-50s.
I'm sure you've got a copy of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
Howard Zinn's People's History?
Yeah.
I did, and I gave it to my local group. I'm getting my local Democratic Party to open up a reading room for people, and we have a group of people that are coming together, and we're shelving a bunch of books for people that don't have any money to come in and read, and I want to get a video player in there so that people can watch some movies, because I went to digital, and I found that by using digital media, I can store a lot more books than I can in paper. But the library is well balanced with both digital media and paper media, because in a depression, Bob, you don't know if you'll have much in the way of energy. But I predict that if we have a depression, that we will not lose our electricity. Because I watched those films about Russia very carefully. And even though Russia went down the tubes and there were people starving, even in the farthest hinterland of Siberia, they always have electricity. Do you know why that's so?
Because that's what props up the moneyed class?
Exactly. You cannot own... Just like when we were pushing west as pioneers, and they pushed people to go west and homestead that land and open up the West. What they wanted to do was overrun the Indians and take the land away. And they can't overrun a country and take us as citizen hostages unless they can communicate with us, and they can't communicate without electricity. So we will always have electricity.
Oh, very true, very true. And in this neck of the woods, it'll be because our politicians are hollering, "Well, we can't stop mountaintop removal because those are the only good jobs we've got left in West Virginia."
And they all belong to those SUV-driving, motorcycle-riding young people, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you don't see just a lot of old, I don't mean old, but older members of the workforce. Most of your mountaintop removal types, the ones I've seen, seem to be late 20s, early 30s, that demographic. And yeah, it's all a shiny new pickup truck, and they probably don't have a retirement plan any more significant than buying next week's lottery ticket.
And they probably came from out of state too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's nothing to go to a mountaintop removal site and see New York and Pennsylvania and Tennessee and Virginia and Kentucky and Ohio license plates. Sure. They don't, you know.
Companies come into an area to do a thing like that. They put the call out for workers in other states because those workers don't have any loyalty to the good people of West Virginia. And for them to destroy your land and destroy your people and destroy your future means nothing to them. Same way that they would run over anybody else for a plug nickel, they'll run over you. And you know what? They get what goes around comes around, Bob. Their day is coming.
God, I hope you're right. Because it's kind of rough being on the receiving end of it all the time. But again, they don't live here.
Yeah.
You know, Massey Energy is headquartered in Richmond, Virginia, not Charleston, West Virginia. They've got a, you know, they've got an office in Charleston, but the headquarters are in Richmond. And that's because a dog never where it eats or sleeps.
Oh, you know, we got the same dog irping over here. We got Weyerhaeuser Timber Company up in Canada that comes down in the state of Washington, Oregon, just strips our hills of trees.
And then the rains come and everything runs off and you've got massive flooding and yeah. And the thing is, what you're looking at are I think it's fair, you know, after 300 years, you can call somebody an indigenous population. And you've got indigenous populations in these areas that are under attack by external forces that are essentially no different from interlopers settling on native lands 200 years ago, Cindy.
Well, these guys that live out in these communities where these trees have been coming out for years, you know, we come from Los Angeles, and we've always been very ecology-minded because we very clearly saw how tons of cement destroyed Southern California. They turned it into a cement nightmare, and we pulled out of there, and we've always been ecology-minded. When we moved up here, we saw how they were clear-cut in the forest, and of course, we joined the local ecology movement, and I would talk to friends that live here, and they go, well, you can't talk like that. That's our bread and butter, taking out those trees. I said, your bread and butter, that's going to take out your house someday when the rains come. Well, guess what? They lost their homes. Their homes went down the river toward the ocean, and they're long gone. They're sitting out there in trailers. They got people sleeping on cots in the high school gymnasium, and they go to the local fire department every day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and to get they've got outhouses and outhouse shower units out there, and they walk between the high school and the fire department, and they line up at the outhouses to go to the bathroom and to get their showers, and then they go to the fire department for a bite to eat, and then they go back to the high school, and nobody's come in trying to rebuild because they can't get in because the roads are out. These people are just out there in the cold. It's 20 degrees today, and they're out there in the cold. And there's a whole county of people like that, a whole county, about 30,000 people, Bob.
That's, and
it's horrifying.
Yeah, it is.
Horrifying.
And that's, well, look, America has forgotten Katrina. America has forgotten the lower Ninth Ward. America has forgotten the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I don't know if America even bothered to think about what you just described. How many thousand people?
I was thinking about Hillary's campaign and how much more money she has than backing her up than anybody else. And I got to remembering that tsunami that hit that island over in Java and how President Clinton and President Bush got together and opened up a collection point for money to go to that island. And when they did that, I had to ask myself, well, how much money does it take to sweep a beach, you know? I mean, it was utter destruction. And what they need is bulldozers to clean the debris off the beach, let these people rebuild. But, of course, that's not what they have in mind. They have in mind building resorts so that the rich can junk it down there. And
sure.
That's the story that's going out. But I wonder how many millions and millions of dollars came pouring into that effort and then went into coffers for election season. I'm wondering about that.
And I think you've got a right to wonder about that.
You know, the whole idea of giving money to this black hole where it goes offshore and it's unaccountable, it just blows my mind. How come everybody thinks it's okay to send money offshore to a foreign nation into a black hole and trust the two biggest crooks that ever sat in the White House before this one? So they'll do that, but they won't send any money to 30,000 people sitting in a county out here in the cold. Bob, someone's calling in. Let me cut.
All right. Well, that's thank you. Thank you, Cindy. I appreciate everything you've mentioned and everything you've brought to the conversation. I'm stymied just thinking.
You heard that last part about sending money overseas to a black hole. And
yes. Yes.
Taking care of our own.
Yes, I did hear it. I did hear it. And I'm, you know, my breath is taken by it. It's
well,
a horror.
We haven't been acting very American. We haven't cared about our own people. And I am incensed by it, you know.
As everybody should be.
You think of your house as being in a neighborhood. Your neighbor's house is down the street. Don't you pay your own bills first to make sure that you're not on the street before you go over and see if your neighbor needs anything? Don't you take care of your own place first and then go help your neighbor next door? Why would you take all the money in the world that you have and put it in an envelope and send it to somebody in another state that you don't know when somebody on your own block is hungry? If we each look to each other the way that we're supposed to, we'll all get along fine, you know? And when somebody calls out for our help, if they're our own American people, my God, that's the American way. We help each other, don't we?
You would think. That's the way it works. Yeah. You would think. Well, Cindy, thank you very much. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you, Bob.
You take care. Bye-bye. Cindy in the great Northwest with some rather profound observations. And let's see who we've got here. Hi, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
Hey, David, how are you?
Hey, did you like those lyrics?
Yes, I did. I did. Okay. I'm fiddling with them and fiddling with some of my own, and I think we're gonna get somewhere with it.
All right, that's good.
It just wasn't quite self-writing like the pastor from Montgomery was for me.
That's a hard one to do because of the rhythmic timing of it.
You've got to work in a short form.
Oh yeah, and the fact that it's the phrasing to it, it's very. You'd like to say a lot, but you can't, kind of thing.
Yeah, I've been thinking in terms of you get Dobson, Robertson, Haggard, Nuts.
Yeah, there
Bundy's you. Come and destroy my home. Yeah, it's coming together.
All right, well, that's good. To pick up what Cindy was saying about the depression coming. I tend to believe that a lot of the reason why a lot of people aren't smiling about and are smiling and a little hopeful is because they're just going to nuke a country, and that's going to continue the illusion for another 100 years, and they're just going to steal the resources from that country.
But God, somebody's got to grow the food, David. I mean, how long can we get along with just being an international cut purse?
Well, here's the thing about that. I think that our food supply is going to be fine, thank you very much, because what's going to happen is we're just going to put the fear of God in them. Unfortunately, that's the kind of people. Did you catch that? Did you cover that Telegraph article yet?
No, I haven't yet.
NATO nuclear attack?
Yeah.
Well, the signs are there. And as far as when the economy starts tanking, see, we have this option. The fact that we have this option on the table, and people will just discuss and say, you know, that country over there, they're not doing anything. They're, nobody's going to care about them. All right, let's attack them.
They're bad people.
It's kind of the same thing, only it's more amplified. You know, it's like you're at the table playing poker, or you're at the roulette wheel, and you're betting everything on something, and you're like, well, that's an easy man's bet right there. I'm going to take that one.
Yeah, red.
They know they can take it.
Red, so. No black. Oh, sorry.
And then they just look at the dealer house, and they're like, you got this one covered, right? And then the Federal Reserve just does their thing and says, all right, yeah, good, solid.
Yeah, we'll print more.
Yeah, and that's why I think the illusion, I really had to say, it's one of the most brilliant, deceptive, evil illusions that has happened in probably U.S. history, what's happening right now. Now, here's something to think about. When they say, Bob, when they say how much a war costs, when they say this war will cost $1 trillion, is that the real amount in terms of like what I mean what the dollar value is right now, or is it a different amount?
I don't know. I get so lost in this, David. It makes my head spin, my eyeballs roll back in my head, and. What is the phrase that Mark keeps using to describe economics? The dismal science.
Bob, have you seen the movie The Prestige yet?
No, I have not.
You watch The Prestige, it'll make sense to you. It's about two magicians who rival each other.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, with Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing movie, and Bowie plays Nikola Tesla in it.
Oh wow! Oh, so it's actually set. It's a period piece.
Yeah, it's a period piece, and what it is it's about. It deals with the elements of free energy, illusion, suspense, and just everything that ties together those themes. And when you watch it, it's kind of like you have to think about it and then think about it. I guess it's from a well-acclaimed novel, and since I'm not that much of a novel reader, maybe you've heard of it or not, but
I can't place it offhand. No.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people have really been driven to it, and there's a lot of themes that represent for what it is today. Also, there's the Paul Thomas Anderson, the There Will Be Blood, about the oil business. In the early 20th century, played by Daniel Day-Lewis. A lot of people were talking about that film. But not too much press on it because, well, if they start talking about that, you might have an actual discussion on your hand.
maybe.
And, you know, just one more thing about the... About the whole the races and all the politics, and I just I think there's something I have to send it to you, Bob. But I think it's a good sign, and it's making me lean toward Edwards. Did you read the letter from Martin Luther King III, Jr. III?
You mean the one to Edwards?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. In fact, I quoted from it last night on the air.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, it just seems to me that we need to just keep on believing what we believe in and just hoping for the best. And I always like this acronym, Bob, and I'll end it on this. Positive energy activates constant elevation.
Positive energy activates P-E-A. Peacle?
Peace.
Sorry. I ran past the E into the L. Yeah, peace.
And regardless of what people think, words mean something because it activates thoughts in your mind, which activates events and situations, and it catapults things. Even though you may not know what's happening, something happens. So keep that in mind, people.
Absolutely. David, thank you very much.
All right, Bob, later.
Take it easy. Bye now. Our pop culture correspondent, David Fermain, getting a little profound on us. But this is profound stuff. This is mind-numbingly difficult stuff to get one's head around. But it's worth considering, because we don't. I've never really considered looking at or trying to figure out what America looks like in the kind of a hole that America was in, say, in the Great Depression. But the thing is, the Great Depression may turn out to have actually been easier because we had something to build upon. Thanks to NAFTA and SHAFTA and CAFTA and DAFTA and RAFTA and PAFTA and LAFTA and all the AFTAs. The stuff that the foundation we had to rebuild on during the Great Depression is gone. It's gone. We can't make shoes in America anymore. We can't make refrigerators or stoves in America anymore. We can't make televisions in America anymore. We cannot make the clothes to put on our backs in America anymore. How do you rebuild when you have nothing to rebuild upon? It's a tough question. It's a very difficult question. The idea of a country, a nation of laws and not of men, that was a radical notion for its time when this nation was founded, is being ripped apart piece by piece now by this gang of thugs that sits in judgment of us all on the Supreme Court. Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, Kennedy. They're taking apart the very foundation of our country, the idea of equal justice under law. The tossing of this lawsuit that I mentioned a few minutes ago, this Enron suit that centers on billions of dollars fraudulently taken from investment plans. This suit was brought by the University of California Board of Trustees. But it's also a lot of people who weren't allowed to sell off their shares in Enron at the same time that Kenny Boy Lay and all of his cronies were doing the same with theirs. And they did so with the connivance of banks like Merrill Lynch. And the court, said, well, that's okay, look, here it is. If you're some working stiff, or you're poor and ignorant, and you're passed out drunk in a car while your buddy goes in and robs the convenience store and murders somebody, we're going to try your ass for felony murder, even though you had no knowledge of it, you had no concept that it was going on, you were utterly a non-participant. We're going to charge you with felony murder, and we'll subject you to the same penalty as the guy who pulled the trigger. And it happens all the time in the United States of America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. It happens all the time. Had an article, I clicked away from it, about a young woman, 28, 29 years old now, who is spending the rest of her days in the California penal system because when she was 16 years old, she murdered the man who had systematically raped, beaten, and abused her for years. She was tried as an adult, and she dodged the gas chamber, but she was sentenced to life with no possibility of parole. She was held to a higher standard of accountability than a silk-suited banker at Merrill Lynch who helped rob millions of people in the Enron scam. In the law of most states, accomplices are criminally liable as accessories either before or after the fact. If you know to the point that if you know something's going to go down and you don't say anything about it, and the thing goes down and it's a criminal act, you can be charged as an accessory before the fact. Or the person commits a crime and you hide them for a little while, you're an accessory after the fact, and you are a criminal in either instance. On the other hand, these Wall Street banking houses that engaged in and participated in and profited from the frauds of Kenny Boy Lay and his accomplices at Enron, they get a free pass from the Supreme Court of the United States. They are not held to the same standard of accountability that we hold an ignorant, tortured, wrecked 16-year-old human being. We hold 16-year-olds to higher standards of accountability than we do 60-year-old billionaire bankers. And that, by God, is the way by which a nation begins to come unglued. Hi, welcome to the program. Who have I got?
This is Alan.
Hey, Alan, how are you, buddy?
Oh, hanging in there. How you doing?
I'm all right.
I missed part of your show today. I think you were referring to the guy in Texas who they're trying to execute because he was, I think, driving the car and somebody who was.
That's one of the cases.
Yeah, that is totally pitiful. I think a lot of people got upset about that and kept them from being killed by the state. But then I think his trial is going to come back up, isn't it?
I think he's going to. I'm not sure. I think he's going to be retried, But again, it's a standard of accountability for that guy that we can't bother to hold a bunch of billionaire rip-off cut purse bankers. I mean, for me, the curtain has really, really been pulled on America, and we can finally. Many people have talked about it over a long period of time, but we are finally seeing it in its most naked, unavoidable form. We're going to write a $145 billion hot check so that George Bush can go out and hand the problems to the next guy or gal.
Yeah. I was just talking to another truck driver, and I said to him, I said, I think we're going to a recession or almost to a depression. And he said, that's funny. That's what my father just told me. And I asked him, how old is your father? And he said his father is like 72. So he probably knows what he's talking about.
Oh, I'd say so. I'd say so.
Yeah.
So.
Well, something seems strange to me that my sister, she has a retail shop in a nice community close to Birmingham. You probably heard of it. It's called Mount Brook, Alabama.
Oh, yeah, I'm very familiar. Yeah,
Well, she tells me when I ask her about business, she says business is just better than it's ever been. So I'm just thinking that the wealthiest people in this country had some way to pull through this.
Well, see that. They've got their money squirreled away. But the other thing is, business for people who sell upscale stuff to upscale people, business is good. I mean, if you sell furniture, say, and you sell furniture to people who buy, you know, $10,000 sofas, business is good. If you sell, on the other hand, furniture to people who buy $200 sofas, business is bad, because the money has all flowed uphill into the hands of people who need it least.
I'm just wondering if they have some plan to make it through a recession like they. I think maybe it's us idiots out here who have a lot of their money tied up into the stock market, and the wealthiest people do not. They have it in something called a hedge fund, which I don't even not even sure what that is.
I can't give a meaningful definition of it because I don't understand it well enough. Maybe, you know, bless his heart, maybe Mark Levine could explain it, but I can't. I probably need to study that issue a little bit and get my head around it.
I think like $100,000 to get into one. I think it's a way to beat the stock market somehow. It's pretty bad.
Well, if you've got enough money, you get to play with the loaded dice, Alan. And it's 7 or 11 every time. On the other hand, if you're a small time investor playing on Wall Street, they hand you the dice that come up snake eyes.
I know it's very, very risky. I have some money in the stock market. I'm ready to get out because it makes it hard to sleep.
Yeah, because you're, and all of a sudden you become a servant of the money instead of the money being a servant of you.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I was looking at this Apple computer on the, I think it's German stock market, and it's down like 10% last night, and then today I think it went down like 15% for a while there. When it closed, it was 10%.
I can't imagine, Alan, how the world markets feel about us.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if they're sitting there and their markets are bleeding, and meanwhile we're sitting here changing the rules in the middle of the game, they can't feel very nice toward it. I mean, that can't engender feelings of comradeship and, you know, we're all in this together now, can it?
I know. We're messing it all up. And it seems like it's so simple that the one thing that can really help the economy more than anything is to get away from the monopolized oil and gas and coal industry. I mean, that seems like to me that would get things going booming, but I think that those industries have bought our politicians out.
Well, if we got serious about our infrastructure and put people to work that way, if we got serious about high new green technology and had people with the industrial entrepreneurial spirit to put that together, it could do wonders for us. But you see, we're not that interested in that kind of thing, Alan. We're interested in propping up the old boys and making sure that the old boys keep having the privilege that the old boys always have. And they're never happy. They're never satisfied. There's never any such thing as enough. As long as there is one poor bastard down here on the bottom end of the ladder who still has a nickel, there's some son of a bitch in a silk suit who wants that nickel. And I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said it that way. I'm not trying to be mean, but you know, I'm sick to death of them. You know, they have the nerve to criticize poor people for wanting the government to help and do a little bit once in a while when they're sitting there and are the greatest beneficiaries of the largest amount of largesse and the greatest amount of welfare that our government can pump out, and they're pissed off over the idea of food stamps. To heck with them, you know?
Welfare for people, and there's a county in Georgia that gets, it's the third largest county to get welfare, third county to get the most welfare than any other county in the, and that's where Newt Gingrich is from.
Yeah, Gwinnett County?
Yeah. So, the wealthy Republicans know how to get their welfare, but they don't want anybody else to get theirs. So I think it's greed at the extreme, and I hope that people are waking up to it.
Well, I hope they are too, but I'm also realistic enough to think that they likely won't.
Yeah, and that's mainly because of the media.
Exactly.
Well, I'll be listening.
Okay. Always glad to know that you are, Alan. You drive careful now.
Okay.
Stay off the slick stuff.
Okay.
All right. Bye now. I forgot to ask Alan where he was. Calling from the Great American Highway, our buddy Alan the Trucker. About 11 minutes before the hour. And, I don't know. Let's see. Yeah, you know, so you know you've been, yeah, you know the Enron thing. Yeah, enough of that. Nah, not enough time for that. Don't feel like fooling with that. Oh, by the, yeah, okay, equal justice under law. Yesterday, Jose Padilla, finally, was sentenced. You remember Jose Padilla, the dirty bomber? The guy that all the networks went to Crisco John Ashcroft so he could announce that we've caught a dirty bomber. He was going to set off a radiological bomb in Chicago. Oh, my God, Jesus helped us catch the dirty bomber. Yeah. It was described in the New York Times as a, get this, only a writer and editor for the New York Times could write something like this. A relatively lenient 17-year prison term. Jose Padilla was sentenced Tuesday to a relatively lenient 17-year prison term. And then the final dependent clause, the prepositional phrase on the end of that sentence, on unrelated terror support charges. Jose Padilla went up the river for 17 years on stuff that had absolutely nothing to do with the charge that he was trying to plot to set off a dirty bomb in the heart of Chicago. Federal prosecutors had to ditch the dirty bomb claim because they couldn't make it stick. They had absolutely no evidence whatsoever, so they just made up some other crap. They had the poor bastard tortured. And I say poor bastard because anybody who gets tortured is a poor bastard. Because he's a human being, whether you like it or not. So they had the poor bastard tortured while he was in the naval brig at Charleston Navy Yards in South Carolina. He was utterly unable to assist in his own defense. He was incompetent to stand trial. And then they made up some crap against him based on what he said while they were torturing him. Padilla, 37 years old, and co-defendants Adham Amin Hassoun, 45, and Kifa Wael Jayousi, 46, were convicted in August of terrorism conspiracy and material support after a three-month trial. Jurors concluded they were part of a support cell that made peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for Al-Qaeda recruits. No, I'm kidding. Jurors concluded they were part of a support cell that sent recruits, money, and supplies to Islamic extremists worldwide, including Al-Qaeda. Padilla was billed as a star recruit. Whew. Tough definition of star. The guy could barely speak by the time his trial came up. He couldn't cooperate with his lawyers because along the way, his torturers and captors had told him, "Hey, guy, dude. You know your lawyers are on our side too, right? You're screwed." And did that to him day after day after day after day after day. The strongest evidence in the case was a form that Padilla completed in the year 2000 to go to Al-Qaeda summer camp in Afghanistan. The CIA says it found the form, you know, wink, wink, found the form after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in late 2001. The federal government wanted life sentences against him. But, no, he got 17 years for filling out a form to go to Al-Qaeda summer camp. "I feel good about everything. This is amazing," said Padilla's mother, Estella LeBron. "He's not a terrorist. He's just a human being. The Justice Department issued its own statement. Thanks to their efforts, the defendant's North American support cell has been dismantled. Kind of hard to dismantle something that never existed. And can no longer send money and jihadist recruits to conflicts overseas, said Kenneth L. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General for National Security, who amazingly is able to look at himself in the mirror every morning. Padilla's lawyers brought to the forefront the fact that Padilla was forced to stand in painful stress positions. He was given LSD or other drugs as truth serum. He was subjected to sleep deprivation, and they even took his mattress away for extended periods of time and played loud noises at him, subjected him to extreme heat and cold and noxious odors. But it wasn't enough to get the judge to say, hey, you know, when you do that kind of crap, you don't get to have a trial. Turn him loose. Equal justice under law. Jose Padilla, 17 years in federal hard time, silk-suited Wall Street banker, free pass and a Christmas bonus. Yay! Meanwhile, Al-Qaeda has had an Ask Al-Qaeda website up. Questions for Ayman al-Zawahiri. Is it okay to wear white after Ramadan? As a matter of fact, it is, as most infidel shrouds are white. When we kill you. Jesus. Okie dokie, then. We're done. Thanks for joining in for prayer meeting tonight. It's always good to have you along. And coming up next, the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio program with the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host, Peter Godbold, with Strictly Confidential. He's also our IT professional and makes all of our computers behave themselves. And that is no small task, and we appreciate him very much for that. We also appreciate our chief engineer, John Fox. Also, staff musician John Fox in Sydney, Australia. Thanks, John. Ben Birch is the hardest working man in liberal talk, has been for years now, having served out millions and millions and millions and millions of hours of liberal talk just to keep the conversation going at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardworking, dedicated people of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Coal River Mountain Watch is trying to create a sustainable future, not just in West Virginia, not just in Appalachia, but in America and the world. CRMW.net. Be part of the solution. Be part of them. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Gather around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 107 of Strictly Confidential. It's a nice prime number this evening. I am Peter Godbold. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday, January the 23rd. 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. on a Wednesday evening in the Eastern time zone, which is January the 23rd of 2008, you're indeed listening to a live show. And you're welcome to call in and participate in Conversation Radio with myself and with the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. The telephone numbers for the show, toll free, 877, the number 4 head on. That's 877-4 head on. Or if you have unlimited long distance, please use that. You'll save the studio a nickel or a buck. As I say, we are listener-supported. And that number is 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and it rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the email during the breaks. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com. And there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the audio archives from the previous shows. You'll find links to the various guests' websites. You'll find links there to the chat room, which is active this evening. And you'll find links to the Head On Radio Network main site. There you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on this network. And you can also participate in helping to support the network with the PayPal button there. You'll keep the packets passing and the cassettes cassetting and the CDs spinning and the hard drives whirring along, and that is very much appreciated. You'll also find links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. What an interesting week it's been so far on this program. We've had so many wonderful people on the show, so many great guests, wonderful music, and it's just been a thrilling week. I have thoroughly enjoyed myself with you, and thank you for spending so much time with us and for supporting this show. We have a wonderful guest this evening. In fact, we've had several guests from the Victory Fund, the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund. Denise Williams is one of them. Denise Williams. Or is it? No, that is Simmons. I'm so sorry. Yep, I am reading off two separate pieces of paper. We are welcoming Denise Simmons to the show. I'm so sorry, Denise. Denise has the distinction of being the first American, African, American lesbian to serve as a mayor of a major city. She is a lifelong resident of Cambridge, and she's raising grandchildren who are currently in the Cambridge Public School.